Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
It's time for today's Lucky Land horoscope with Victoria Cash.
Life's gotten mundane, so shake up the daily routine and be adventurous with a trip to Lucky Land. You know what they say, your chance to win starts with a spin. So go to LuckyLandSlots.com to play over 100 social casino-style games for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Get lucky today at LuckyLandSlots.com.
Available to players in the U.S., excluding Washington and Michigan. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
If you're snacking on anything but tasty cake, you're making a huge Miss Cake. A fistful of chocolate-covered raisins? Miss Cake. A spoonful of peanut butter? Bigger Miss Cake. Or the worst Miss Cake of all, your kid's Halloween candy, and it's April. If it's not tasty cake, it's a Miss Cake. Because nothing satisfies like a perfectly sweet butterscotch crimpet or rich and creamy chocolate peanut butter candy cake. Tasty cake. Accept no substitute.
Hey, everybody, and welcome to the Billboard.com Pop Shop Podcast. My name is Keith Caulfield, and I am the co-director of charts at Billboard. The Billboard Pop Shop Podcast is your one-stop shop for all things pop on Billboard's weekly charts. In addition, you can always count on a lively discussion about the latest pop news, fun chart stats and stories, new music, and guest interviews with music stars and folks from the world of pop. Today on the show, we've got Coming Around Again with Billboard.com Senior Associate Editor Andrew Unterberger. Andrew will be chatting with Billboard's Gary Trust and Trevor Anderson of the Chartbeat podcast, talking about Michael Jackson's Bad album and how the set scored a then-record 5 number ones on the Hot 100 back in 1987 and 1988, and where that achievement ranks among the all-time historic Billboard chart records, and where the album ranks for both Gary and Trevor personally within MJ's catalog. But first, before we get started, if you enjoy the podcast, subscribe to the show on iTunes so you won't miss an episode, and give us a rating or review while you're at it. And if you want to explore more podcasts from Billboard, visit iTunes.com/Billboard Podcasts. So before we get into the bad talk, did you know that Bad actually generated a total of 7 hit singles on the Hot 100 chart? So in addition to its 5 number ones, which happened to be also its first 5 singles, it also spun off a number 11 hit in Another Part of Me and a number 7 single in Smooth Criminal. In total, over Michael's entire career, he has tallied 50 hits on the Hot 100 chart, with 29 of those hitting the top 10, most recently with Love Never Felt So Good with Justin Timberlake back in 2014, and a total of 13 of Michael's singles have reached number one. So let's go back to 1987 and talk all things Bad on Coming Around Again.
Hello and welcome to Coming Around Again, Billboard's anniversary theme podcast celebrating anniversaries in the music world. Today we have a crossover episode. Got Gary Trust and Trevor Anderson from the Billboard Chartbeat podcast. What's up, guys?
It's the all-star podcast.
Indeed.
It's like that Futurama Simpsons crossover or something like that.
Those are weird. I don't like the animated crossover so much.
Okay, well, it's not the Futurama Simpsons crossover, apparently.
But in any event, have you guys ever been on another Billboard pod before?
I've been on the Pop Shop podcast with Keith.
Okay, right, yeah.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
Yeah. Keith and Katie, yeah. Sure.
We're all family. We're all friends, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I wanted to have you guys on today because it is the 30th anniversary of Michael Jackson's Bad album. It's a big one for Billboard, especially because, and a personal favorite of mine, because it holds the record for the most number one singles on the Hot 100 of any album ever. At least it did for about 2 decades, and so before it was tied. But
still does. Just
still does. Yeah,
but shares the record.
No longer the sole proprietor there. But this is one of my favorite Billboard chart records, I think, partly because it's not one that a lot of people would expect this particular album to have. I think most people would say, oh, yeah, it's probably Michael Jackson album that has it, but they would guess, you know, Thriller or maybe Off the Wall, more so than Bad. I also find a lot of the songs pretty interesting. I think it's just an interesting time in chart history in general. Where does this rank for you guys in the kind of pantheon of great, weird Billboard chart records?
Gary threw it to me. It is a good record, because obviously people pay attention to sort of the all-star records in terms of mm-hmm. songs, you know, songs with most number one. We saw that obviously this year get tied as well. Artists with the most number ones. But, you know, it's when you have to like sort of pin it to one specific album, and you know, there's also a lot of talk where a lot of people, you know, nowadays or back then could do two songs hit number one from an album, and mm-hmm. you kind of just shove it and go on to the next album, and you sort of can sort of pad your total in that sense. But to have, you know, a full body of work that has to produce 5 number one albums, that's pretty special. And obviously the album does well itself, so it's kind of a twofer on that.
And you kind of get different generations, because it seemed like it was never going to be matched. And then Katy mm-hmm. Perry did it. So you sort of have the 80s fans, the traditionalists, versus maybe younger fans who lived through Katy Perry doing it. So you kind of have this fun cross-section of different generations with these two albums.
Yeah, whenever these records can last for entire decades, multiple decades, and you know, we saw this recently, obviously, with Despacito tying One Sweet Day's Hot 100 Stay record.
Right.
It's a special thing, because it means that the record was meaningful in the first place. And, you know, it took so long. It took, you know, almost 30 years of the Hot 100's existence for one album to spawn this many Hot 100 number ones. And then it took almost another quarter century for another album to match it.
Right.
And that's, that does feel like history when it's happening, especially when you've seen so many other albums come close but not quite get there.
Yeah, and there's been other records recently that seem a little more, just the way the charts are now, like Weeks in the Top 10. We mm-hmm. just saw a Closer tie the record, and then Shape of You. So that's 2 in the last year. So that's a little different, as opposed to something that did something in the 80s and then just one other album in the 2010s. So this one, it does seem like it's one of the more hallowed records.
Yeah, and it seems like... It requires a lot of context being in place. You know, it's the sort of record that's only even possible to happen in very specific like pockets of chart history, because other times there's just periods where singles are on top for 10, 12 weeks at a time, and you only get, you know, 10 to 15 number ones in a year, and it's impossible for 5 of them to come off the same album. So you need these like very specific periods of high concentrations of number one singles, and I guess we were in one in the late 80s, and we were very briefly in one earlier this decade, but who knows when it'll happen again.
Yeah, I think what's interesting, and one of the keys that Michael Jackson was able to do this, and then Katy Perry to tie it, is that the late 80s was such a time of pure pop. So you had mm-hmm. a lot of albums going 4, 5, 6, even 7 singles deep, because it was before grunge, it was before hip-hop really took hold. Country would be so big in the 90s. So mid to late 80s was still a time of just pop ruling everything, and you
right.
had consensus. So you could put out a hit, everybody would know it, because pop was really everything. And then if you look at when Katy Perry did this in 2010, 2011, that was kind of a resurgence of pop at the time. You had Taylor Swift and Gaga. And
Kesha.
Yeah.
You're going to give 2010, 11 Taylor the pop mantle?
She had a couple pop crossovers, Love Story and You Belong With Me at that point.
Okay. All right.
I think of that as like the Gaga, Kesha, and even sort of the Black Eyed Peas era. Like that was what kind of ushered in that new wave of sort of mega
right.
pop, which is, I guess, also kind of what we had in the late 80s
right.
with these blockbuster artists.
So two kind of similar times when pop was at a high point, and that's when they both did it. Mm-hmm.
And if you could kind of pinpoint one specific reason, like in one sentence, why Bad was the specific album to make this chart record, what would you say is the biggest reason?
I think part of it was... other albums came very close. George Mike, where we were just saying this on the Chartbeat podcast, a plug for the Chartbeat podcast.
Shameless.
This week.
I like it.
that George Michael, at the same time, Faith had four number ones plus a number two.
Yeah.
So it feels not to take anything away from Bad, but it feels like other albums came really close and could
Paul
have.
Abdul four Paul number Abdul, ones and a number
yeah.
three.
Janet Jackson with seven top tens. So
seven top fives, right?
Seven top fives. Yeah,
that's one of the absolute insane ones, I think.
But yeah, for the story you did for Billboard.com too, Andrew, there was such
plug.
I'm just plugging everything here. There was such a push on the label side that Michael Jackson wanted history. So I think they really weren't going to stop until they did everything they could to get this record.
Yeah, some of the stories connected with the rollout of that album are pretty insane. You know, they had this party at Michael Jackson's house in Encino where they basically brought out the entire record industry to come and hear the album and be wined and dined and kind of cajoled into, you know, giving it the best promo foot forward. And there was like a half hour of CBS TV special that debuted the night before the album came out, which back then was a very big deal. You know, I guess there was plenty of MTV type specials like that, but to get something like that on primetime was pretty rare. And we sort of touched on this already, but it seems like one of, if not the biggest factors in this was that there were just so many number ones to go around that year. It's almost like the steroid era for the charts. You know, I think we saw that there were 33 in 1988 alone that spent at least 1 week on top and none more than 4 weeks. So it made sense that it was possible for Michael Jackson to kind of, notch this stratospheric amount of number ones just because it was wide open. There would be, you know, the Terence Trent D'Arby would be on for 1 week and then he would fall off. And then, Rick Astley would be on for 1 week and then he would fall off. And it was just this constant kind of carousel of number one hits.
Yeah, it was. As you reported, it was a time when labels cared about just getting to number one. It didn't really matter how long they were number one. So 1 week was fine. They'd let someone else do the same thing.
Right. And the other seems like the biggest factor that we haven't talked about yet was that it happened to be following up the biggest selling album of all time. Thriller came out about a half decade earlier. Sold. I mean, the numbers are inexact. I think at the time, but certainly sold tens of millions of copies by the time Bad came out. Had seven top ten hits. Had a couple number ones. It only had two number ones, which is probably surprising considering how many of those songs, you know, still classics today, still here on radio, at weddings, etc. But, it set the stage, as high as any other album ever has for the chart success of the follow-up. This is actually kind of one of my favorite recurring phenomenons just in Billboard chart history is when, you know, the song that everybody knows by the artist doesn't go to number one, but then the next album's first single does. Do you guys have any favorite examples of that or albums that kind of build off the momentum of previous albums?
Yeah, I thought of one. I think that's an interesting phenomenon, too. I think one of the quotes, again, from that story was someone said that a Thriller did the heavy lifting.
Sure.
They did the work for Bad. More recent example, or at least this decade, Mumford & Sons.
Oh, right.
Sign No More. It was a huge album, but the singles, you know, they did well, but it was almost that the first single from the next album probably was going to be bigger just because the profile had been raised at that point. And I Will Wait is their biggest hit, but people might think Little Lion Man is maybe one of their more known songs that didn't even hit the top 40. I Will Wait hit number 12. So, yeah, you see that sometimes.
And that whole album, too. Like, you know, I don't know how many Mumford & Sons, like, stands out there. I don't know if there are still that many Mumford & Sons stands out there, but I bet you most of them would probably point to Sign No More as being the better album and maybe even the more popular album. But
right. It did last longer in the charts, but number two versus number one peak.
But and Babel had the amazing first week sales and all the Grammy wins and stuff like that. I was thinking of a couple actually artists from your era, Gary, but
my era,
my era too. In retrospect, but
podcast goes black
not
and white
around for. But Duran Duran, "Hungry Like the Wolf" is probably their most famous song, only a number three hit on the Hot 100. But "The Reflex," first single off of "Seven of the Ragged Tiger," the album after that,
right?
And that was the first number one,
right?
And Depeche Mode, "Songs of Faith and Devotion," I think was their only number one album on the Billboard 200. Even though I think actually it's one of my favorite Depeche Mode albums, but most fans would probably consider it a second tier album of theirs, and certainly compared to Violator, the album that came before that, not necessarily didn't have the same legs in terms of the singles and in terms of the the radio support, but goes down in history as their highest charting Billboard 200 album.
Yeah, you saw that back. I'll give a really deep example here for freestyle fans listening from the late 80s. Stevie B.
Okay,
tell
sure.
Me you've
yeah.
heard of him.
Oh, yeah.
He had a couple songs that peaked in the 30s in 1989, but I Want to Be the One.
In My Eyes, was that?
In My Eyes. And those are kind of considered as classics. But then after that, he had the big ballad, the Postman song,
sure.
Because I Love You. It was a 4-week number one hit. But I think a lot of people maybe don't consider that part of his great freestyle catalog.
Mm-hmm. Flashing forward to the Teenage Dream era for a minute. I don't know how entrenched you guys were in the Hot 100, the trenches there when the album was really popping. I was working for not for Billboard, but for a different pop blog, and I was following every week the singles progress. So it's got 3, it's got 4. Now Last Friday Night is climbing, and maybe it's going to get to number 1. I mean, were you guys rooting for it to happen, or were you trying to preserve the sanctity of the MJ record? How were you guys reacting to that at the time?
I was working here, and I was writing the Hot 100 weekly story then. So we were, if nothing else, we root for an interesting story because
sure.
It just sort of makes it fun for everybody. So when you get that close, and other albums have gotten 4, but not 5, it really was fun to watch that happen. And Capitol Records was really pushing for it. They were really aware of it. So they knew what they could match if they did that. So it was a big deal to them too.
So do you have specific memories of like the kind of things that Capitol would do that made it seem like this was really something that was on their minds?
Well, they put Kanye in the remix
sure.
For the single version of E.T. Mm-hmm. So that added a little bit more reach to it by bringing in maybe some fans that weren't necessarily Katy Perry fans, mixing genres a little bit. My real memory of that is one of the executives at Capitol took the same Metro North train as me. So I'd see him in the morning. I remember one day where it wasn't certain if one of the songs was going to go to number 1. And I feel like he kept just pushing me closer to the platform until he got the answer that he wanted. Maybe I made that up, but I always felt like there was getting a little too close to the edge there.
And what about you, Trevor?
Well, as someone who did not work here, I was paying attention. I mean, and that's a good pop album. So I think sure. in the initial part, when California Girls was number 1, everyone kind of saw that coming, lead single after the big breakthrough album. No surprise there. Teenage Dream, fantastic song. No one was upset with that. Firework, good enough song. There's also this kind of weird
dissing Firework.
I guess that was a diss, but it's not as good as Teenage Dream, but it is still a very good pop song.
I think it may have lasted better than Teenage Dream.
It
definitely, but it lends itself to bigger occasions. I mean, it's more, an anthem than, you're not going to hear Teenage Dream at the club, and you're not going to hear it, obviously, on the 4th of July or New Year's Eve, or, there's something much bigger about it. So I think it has lasted with that advantage. E.T., was fine. Was great, too. I mean, Kanye West, I thought really... I actually like the version with Kanye.
I like the Kanye verse a little bit.
Yeah, it's...
It's not bad.
Look like it's one of his better features, probably, on a pop song.
And it's like one of the last times that he would do like a feature like that. Like, I'm sure if Katy Perry offered him a feature now, or whoever the 2017 equivalent
right.
is, he probably wouldn't do it. It's not... going for that kind of pop crossover is no longer one of Kanye's top priorities,
no.
it would seem.
And I remember thinking at the time that might be the one to miss because mm-hmm. she had been so pure pop. And that was really her first song that was pretty different with kind of trap elements. So when that went to number 1, I was thinking, okay, she may have this mm-hmm. because now everything's working for her.
And then I remember, of course, there was the 5th song, Last Friday Night. And I mean, I guess as a chart watcher kind of fan, you felt like it definitely did have the more push behind it. I mean, made the video, this giant event, this 8-minute video. They wanted everybody to be involved with it. And then, of course, the Missy Elliott remix.
I'm glad you mentioned the Missy remix. I thought we were going to be remiss not to talk about that a little bit.
Of course not. That was one of those things where, because the song was in like number 2, number 3 at the time.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, you kind of at that point just give in and say, okay, this is going to happen. But then when that remix came out, just to, kind of help put it over the top, that's the first time. Because I think it happened earlier that year with the same thing with Rihanna, with Britney Spears.
Right, yeah, S&M, sure.
S&M had that same situation. So... I think given those kind of back-to-back, it made you think, okay, are people that sort of desperate for a number 1, that a number 2 is not going to be good enough for these superstar acts? Had the remix with Missy Elliott not come out, and who knows if the song would got to number 1 without it, as a chart watcher, I would have felt a little more okay with that,
mm-hmm.
but I just feel like, I know you can obviously, it's on labels half, it's a game, it's a strategy as well. So all's fair, but I felt like, Michael didn't have to...
Yeah, it felt like a tiny bit of an asterisk, right? Just the slightest bit. I mean...
I would like to be excluded from this narrative.
Well, you're not about the chart asterisk in general, Gary, but that's why you have me here to talk about these things. It was an enlightening moment for me as a kind of an outsider to the Billboard universe at the time, both showing the kind of machinations that the labels would go to get songs to number one. And just the fact that they cared that much, like I obviously cared, but as a nerdy sort of pot watcher, kind of like some of the way you care about like tracking stats obsessively in sports, but like the fact that the labels were able to kind of put these wheels in motion so that they ensure that this would be a thing that would happen, it just shows really the power of the Billboard charts and shows the power of the Hot 100 and of this record specifically, because clearly this was a thing that the Capitol cared about, that Katy Perry cared about. Being in league with Michael Jackson, even if it isn't his number one album, is still a pretty powerful thing.
And it's amazing too, I think, how much of the fans really get into this. I mean, we saw it this week with Despacito, One Sweet Day. I mean, you know, when people equate records, they believe that equates, you know, talent or prestige or influence or whatnot. And I mean, I'm sure Katy Perry would be the first person to say, you know, she's not Michael Jackson. She's not trying to compete with Michael Jackson. But it is kind of cool that the fans, like, think that those records for those particular people are so important that they don't want anybody to touch them. They don't want anybody to come close to them, you know, as a way to solidify, you know, in a quantitative way, like, just how great these great ones are.
Yeah, no, and they're willing to put it out there to make some threats and to say some things that don't necessarily make us the most comfortable as the gatekeepers of these stats, but you appreciate the passion at all times.
Yeah, I'm not sure in 2011 Twitter or social media were quite what it is
now. Comments would have been flying for you, Gary.
We had the comment section. I don't know these stories, but
not in real time, not the Facebook Live stuff that is now.
A little different.
Yeah, I was definitely not rooting for the Katy Perry album. I was not a Katy Perry fan, especially at the time. But I do have to kind of. I respect the fact that, like, all five singles were big singles and all five singles were very different from each other. And that was one of the things that I liked about the batch of bad singles as well, is that, like, even though, you know, we'll get into the nitty-gritty of them in a minute, but, like, even though not all of them were necessarily, like, among Michael's all-time classics, none of them really overlapped with each other. They all had very distinct identities. And even from his other singles, the singles before that, singles came after, but certainly from one another, they're all five very different songs. They have five very different videos, five very different feels. And I think that makes it kind of more of an accomplishment when you hit number one five times to be doing it, you know, taking chances each time and not just kind of repeating yourself over and over again. So I definitely have respect for Katy Perry for sort of doing the same thing there. Now let's talk about the songs a little bit. So just running them off real quick. First one was I Just Can't Stop Loving You, the lead single off the album, had no music video, but did have a duet appearance by Saida Garrett, I think it is.
Yeah. I think Saida.
Saida Garrett, sorry about that. And, I think she was supposed to be a little bit more of a star. Like, they were supposed to get a Whitney Houston or Barbara Streisand type to appear on the song, but instead they got Saida, who was one of the stable songwriters that Quincy Jones had.
Isn't that amazing to think that, you know, in 1987, that given the opportunity to record with Michael Jackson, that Barbara and I think Aretha was also thrown in there at some point, and Whitney would all, I mean, I know they were all probably doing their own albums, their own rollouts, but it feels like, I mean, that's almost like a guaranteed hit. Like, right. And to not take that, that's
Whitney
incredible.
Already had so many of her own that year that maybe she just didn't. Maybe her, you know, that was still the time that labels were worried about overexposing their artists at least a little bit, right? Like, I don't know if she – and maybe just she would have created traffic for her own hits on the top of the charts. So I don't know if that would have been a reason to kind of keep her off that song.
I feel like the song now is a little forgotten in terms of his hits. So maybe if it had been, a Whitney, Michael Jackson, it might stand up a little bit better now.
I think when you even listen to it, it can be kind of hard to like keep their voices distinct from one another.
Certainly. Yeah.
Obviously, Michael doesn't have the most, you know, gruff, masculine voices to begin with. And when they're kind of – twisting around each other in the upper registers, it's like, oh, is there even another voice in the song, or is this just Michael kind of double tracking himself?
Right.
And way they also like switch off parts, like whoever ends the chorus. And I mean, so the first time you hear it, you think it's Saida. The second time you might think That's Saeed. Wait, no, that's Michael, actually. Yeah,
yeah. I mean, it's a great song. It really, it's probably, it's solid, probably song, underappreciated. Yeah. I think it's really well written and orchestral and a very pretty adult kind of a song. Mm-hmm. It just you don't hear it much now on radio. It just feels.
I heard it, though, the time the day that he died. That was the first time I heard this song on the radio, really? Though. But it sounded great coming like off a radio station. It really did.
Yeah.
Yeah, and inadvertently helped launch the career of Sheryl Crow as well. She, you know, she was touring. They make a big point of this in the Bad 25 documentary, but she was touring instead of Saeeda Garrett because I think she was trying to launch her own solo career that never quite got off the ground. And Sheryl Crow was the backup singer that ended up taking her place on the song, duetting with Michael and kind of doing a little romantic tango with him. And, you know, flash forward to 5 years later, she was certainly a much bigger star than Saeeda Garrett ever became.
But maybe there's something.
Ouch.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess true, but ouch.
I was going to say, maybe there's something to be said for the song became a hit on its own merits a little bit more.
If it
had just been Michael Jackson and Whitney Houston or someone bigger, it might have just been the star power. So, yeah, maybe pay attention to the song a little bit more.
But I think it's also probably safe to say that if this song was the fifth or sixth single off the album, it probably would not have gone to number one. No, not safe to say? I don't know. It seems like this was definitely a momentum number one. It was a, hey, Michael's back. He doesn't need a music video. He doesn't need a big co-star. It's the first we've heard of him since Thriller, aside from, you know, some scraps here and there. That's got to be taken pretty heavily into account, I think, when talking about the song getting to number one.
Yeah, I think placement certainly helped. And I we'll talk about Man in the Mirror in a minute, but I feel like that's probably a stronger song. That would be a number one no matter when it was released. So I think there's a difference between the two ballads singles.
Yeah, no, definitely. And it should also be stated that there was some logic to making this the first one because, you know, they were basically saying, well, what are we doing with Thriller? A Thriller, we had The Girl Is Mine. That was also kind of a slow traditional ballad. It was a duet, again, with a much bigger star than Saeeda Garrett and Paul McCartney, but also no music video and kind of just maybe just like a, you know, test the waters a little bit sort of song. And that's what they did with this one and worked out pretty well. So that was number one, number one. Number one, number two was the album's title track, Bad. First song on the album, first music video, and it was the video that premiered on the CBS special that they had before the album came out. So it was probably the first taste of the album that a lot of people got. And it was very much, you know, a statement of intent. It was bad. What do you remember thinking of that song at the time when it came out, Gary?
The thing's on my mind now is it was actually a little bit before I was so into music. It took like another year or so before I got obsessed and never
took to the fifth number one.
Yeah.
So you were like 13 at the time, right?
Yeah. It took about the spring of 88. So when you're that age, a few months makes a big difference. But I was just reading a difference. You guys did a whole story of people going song by song on Billboard.com. Another story.
Another plug.
So Prince was invited to be on this song, but he didn't want to be on it.
Yeah, there's a number of differing stories about this. One story is that Prince, you know, all of them have Prince being invited to be on the song and him and obviously not ending up doing it. Some people say that the objection was that he didn't want to get outshined by Michael. Some people say that he just didn't think the song needed him. And I think the most popular one, I think the one that Trevor even wrote a trivia question about in our office trivia competition.
This is what Prince told Chris Rock when he had an interview.
According to Prince, he says that the opening line, "Your butt is mine," was a little contentious as to, you know, was Michael going to be saying it to Prince? Was Prince going to be saying it to Michael? And really, either way, it was no good. So which do you choose to believe, Trevor?
I would like to think the third one is true because it's perfectly a great anecdote and it's very petty, but it's also something that I think
proto-petty almost.
Oh, for sure. And I think it's one of the things you have to, you know, given the context, especially of what, I mean, Michael and Prince, you know, obviously the Michael Prince war had already been kind of going on at the time, Thriller, Purple Rain, all that kind of thing. But I mean, to have an opening line like that, perhaps in 1987, when there are rumors, you know, I mean, Prince is not the most masculine fellow in his appearance or his mannerisms. Michael obviously has, you know, plenty of question marks around him as well. I think, I mean, maybe from even like a PR standpoint, Prince, you know, was in a way being cautious, being smart.
Or was it that Prince really was in awe of Michael Jackson because he had been in the business so much longer? It seemed like Prince actually didn't want to be upstaged.
Yeah, I mean, that's Quincy's theory about it, certainly. I talked to
Quincy's theory.
My buddy Q, who I spent a couple of minutes with the other night, he says, you know, we invited him in, and you know, we sat across the table from him, and we talked to him for a little bit, but he said, well, you know, you don't need me on the song. But his own theory is that, you know, he was a little bit gun shy about competing with Michael, and that, like, he had actually had a studio session with Prince, you know, several years earlier, and Prince was a deer in headlights, and that the lights were too bright coming from Michael. But Michael had been a star for 20 years already at that point almost, and Prince was still relatively new, although, you know, Prince had been around for almost a decade by that point too. So still maybe a different stratosphere, and you can kind of see it in the fact that, you know, Prince, I guess, came out in 1999, and around the time that Michael came out with Thriller, same year.
Not the year 1999, the album 1999.
The album 1999, in 1982, same year as Michael Jackson's Thriller. And then he releases, I guess, 5 other albums in the space that it takes Michael to make Bad. Probably, right? Or at least 4, I guess. It's Purple Rain, Around the World in a Day, the Parade,
the Under the Cherry Moon soundtrack.
And Sign of the Times, which I think comes out earlier in 1987.
Right.
And is a double album, so you want to count that as 5, and that's it's either 4 or 5. But yet, Michael is still the bigger star, having done nothing in this time, basically. Right. And that's pretty crazy to think about. And it might have, you know, added to the enmity there a little bit, or it might have just made Michael seem so much larger than life that maybe Prince doesn't want to go 10 rounds with him. I think either way makes sense.
Well, that's a weird dynamic between the two of them. I mean, that carries on forever. I mean, yeah. I know Will.i.am was on the Graham Norton show a couple years ago, and he said that he and Michael Jackson, because, you know, Will.i.am also did a lot of work with Michael before he died, and did some of the projects on the 25th anniversary of Thriller album. And he said that he and Michael went to a Prince show. I'm not sure when this was. You know, probably in the 2000s later, and they went to a Prince show, and I guess Prince noticed Michael was there, and so Will said that Prince, like, went down and played the guitar, like, right in Michael's face, like, just the whole time, like, mm-hmm. you know, just making a show of it and whatever, and then Michael apparently went home and was, you know, wondering, why is Prince being such a meanie? And so I guess I think he said that Prince has, like, never liked him or something, so it's that relationship in itself is always kind of interesting.
It's definitely really interesting, especially because, you know, that story you just told kind of illustrates it. Prince was both Michael and Quincy in one person, basically.
Yeah.
You know, Michael was the interpreter, and he was the writer. You know, he became the writer. You know, in the bad years, he wrote most of the songs, but certainly he wasn't the kind of auteur that Prince was. He didn't play all the instruments himself. He didn't produce the records himself. He was the instrument more so than the creator in a lot of ways, whereas Prince was both of those things and so much more. But yet Michael was still the bigger star and probably always had been and always would be to a certain extent. So yeah, there's definitely a really interesting dynamic between the two of those. The version without Prince, still like a pretty storming song, like pretty like exciting song, Bad. It's got some questionable lyrics, I would say. Maybe some questionable intentions, but what do you guys think of the song?
I don't put it up there with his classics. I feel like the next two songs we'll talk about are the two standouts of this single. Mm-hmm. So I feel like it's just kind of I hate to use the word gimmicky, but a little bit sort of about just the title of the album. It just kind of feels like it hasn't aged maybe as well as it could have.
But I do like the energy of the song. I think it's a. I don't think he put out anything in his catalog that had quite the same energy. I guess Beat It is probably the easiest comparison to say. But I feel like if you listen to that song, like, even, like, just driving your car with the windows down, like, I know that's kind of the quintessential example. But there's something fun about that song, like, that... And even if you don't think Michael Jackson is bad, that almost adds to the enjoyment of it. Is like, I'm just singing this fake song that you know, I don't really believe it. Like, I'm not really intimidated by it, but it's just like... It's just fun for all the good kids out there to think that they're bad for a minute, too.
Yeah, I mean, the lyrics are definitely a little bit weird in trying to promote Michael Jackson's badness. The line about, like, then won't you slap my face? Like, I'm still not quite sure what that means. But yeah, like you said, there's definitely something fun about the song. I remember I was listening to it this morning, actually, on the way to work. And, like, just that bass groove, like, you walk into it, that's a thing for sure.
You know what I actually think of when I think of this song is Weird Al Yankovic's parody.
No, I watched that video. I'm sorry, go on.
Yeah, Fat. So number 99 hit 2 weeks on the Hot 100, which is just sort of funny in itself. It just barely hit the chart, but Eat It was from Thriller. Sure. So I was looking at Weird Al's Hot 100 history. Michael Jackson is the only artist he had two parody hits with on the Hot 100.
That's interesting.
So another tie-in between Thriller and Bad.
And also, I guess, Weird Al trying to replicate the Thriller formula by going with Fat and off Bad instead, and another food-themed hit, no less.
Right.
Yeah.
I watched that video for the first time, like, since I was, 12, whatever, since my Weird Al days this morning, and it's actually pretty clever. Like they get a lot of like kind of little things right.
Right.
And by the way, if you want to look at the Wikipedia entry for Weird Al's Fat, you can see a list of literally every similarity between Fat and Bad.
Yeah.
I don't know who took the time to do this. I don't know what service they thought they were providing, but it is stunning.
There are Michael Jackson stands, and I guess Weird Al stands out there too.
And the video is great too, and the Bad video is another like really, really interesting part of this album to me. I mean, it was maybe not the most ambitious video he'd done yet, because he'd already done Thriller, which is another double-digit minute-long mini-movie with a big director and a script and all that. But he'd never tried to do anything quite this serious before. This is basically like him doing like his feature film acting debut. But then it also turns into this ridiculous musical at the end of it. What do you guys think of the video?
Yeah, there's a lot going on.
There's a lot going on. Martin Scorsese directing, Richard Price was this I think Potboiler novelist wrote the script, and Wesley Snipes, the great Wesley Snipes, making his basically his film debut in the video. There's a lot to chew on there, certainly.
Yeah, it should almost feel like they hitched their wagon to this song. Maybe this was going to be the big statement. I just think 30 years later, it's not the song. It's the title cut, but I don't think it's the song you really think of when you think of the singles from this album. So there was so much push behind it. It was a number one hit, but I just keep coming back to it. It gets a little bit forgotten among even the hits from that album.
But I go back to the video. I do have to say I love the transformation literally of Michael Jackson from, Yale prep school kid to this greaser with this.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess this is really he'd already obviously been a fan of military jackets and those things we've seen around, but this is sort of the first leather and chain kind of era that we see him in. And when everyone drops from the ceiling and they squat up at the back.
They've been hiding there the entire time in the Hoyt-Skinhorn subway station.
Yeah,
it's pretty absurd.
It's just an amazing clip with just the emphasis on the trumpets and everything. It's just such a big is this really happening? Michael Jackson's about to jump me. Is this really how it's going to go down?
Yeah, it's like, I don't know, you're watching an episode of The Wire, and then all of a sudden it turns into West Side Story. It's so absurd, the juxtaposition between the two halves of the video. But they're both fun in their own ways. It's a very strange thing. But I think Kanye actually called that Michael Jackson look like his favorite Michael Jackson look, with the head-to-toe leather and the zippers and all that. It's endured for some people, but maybe the fashion of it better than the actual song. So the third single, The Way You Make Me Feel, is probably the least controversial single off this album, I would say. The least contentious, and certainly the one that everyone has generally positive feelings for. I mean, I guess maybe the next one we'll talk about too, but The Way You Make Me Feel, it's hard to imagine how somebody could kind of not like that song.
Yeah, well, the first single, it's got all the attention of being the first single. Bad, it's got the video, it's got the title cut. It feels like this one is, now we're just judging the songs for what they are. And it's got that shuffle beat. It sounds different than maybe any other single he's done. It's a great melody. I think this one, of the three we've talked about so far, really stands up the best.
Yeah, I think definitely it's one of the few Michael Jackson songs in his catalog that is really Michael trying to get the girl. He's obviously been an adult for a while now, but kind of moving into that frontier for one of the very first times. It's not a, Jackson 5 kind of bubblegum crush song. And there are, more ballads and romantic kind of tributes on Off the Wall and Thriller. This is kind of the first, I guess you could say, if you want to think of Michael Jackson as Bad, this is his first sort of playboy-y, somewhat anthem. Still soft, not disrespectful, but in terms of lyric development, I think a big step for him too.
Yeah, it's interesting. Someone I talked to for one of the Bad articles we did mentioned that, well, first for I Just Can't Stop Loving You, that he'd never really done a song with a female co-lead before. He's done songs with other collaborators, but they didn't really have that on Thriller. And then Thriller also didn't really have, like you're saying, didn't have that song of him kind of playing the lover man. And I guess PYT sort of did, but PYT didn't have a video. And so you got to see kind of Michael play the romantic lead basically for the first time in the video for the way you make me feel.
But I mean, like, he's literally, like, you know, the phrase, you really turn me on, like, yeah. That is a, you know, that's not going to be on a PYT kind of thing.
But it's set to such this happy music. It's kind of that, you don't realize maybe the lyrics are that adult. It sounds just like a bouncy, happy little pop song.
Yeah.
And the video is, like, takes place in, like, a very dark alley, and apparently, you know, the original concept for it had involved street gangs in some capacity, and the director actually hired actual street gangs to play it. So
Michael is a fan of the street gangs. I mean, you look at Beat It, now you look at the Bad video. Like, he's a gang dude.
But yeah, if this isn't the most beloved song on this album, it's probably the next one we're going to talk about, which is Man in the Mirror. It was a mega ballad, one of the few songs on the album not written by Michael, written by Saida, who was the co-star on I Just Can't Stop Loving You, and Glenn Ballard, who did he go on to have success with Alanis Morissette?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He co-wrote the Jagged Little Pill hits.
Yeah, and I was starting to wonder if I was making that up.
I always try to make sure I mention Wilson Phillips before that, too. He did the first Wilson Phillips album.
The entire album?
I want to say co-wrote or produced Hold On, some of those hits, but he was behind that.
That's legitimate.
Yeah.
Are you guys with the consensus on Man in the Mirror?
You know, it's funny. I've been kind of brainwashed not to be. My father was not a fan of this song in particular. Like, you'd always kind of skip it on the collections. He always thought it was too, like, you know, sappy or too, like, wussy or whatever. So I hadn't heard the song until probably I was, like, 14, 15. I think it's a beautiful song. I mean, obviously Michael is very much after the Thriller and all the mega success he has, moving towards a more humanitarian perspective. That's why I think one of the most interesting things on the song Bad is like that little bridge when he like sort of goes from being bad and he's like, you know, we can change the world tomorrow.
Yeah, no,
this can be a better place. Yeah. And I'm like, this is the most random thing to throw in to this song. But I guess it really, you know, underlines how much he cares about that. Obviously, co-written We Are the World a few years earlier with Lionel Richie, so this is really on the forefront of his mind. And, you know, it's kind of interesting because even though it's, I think, one of Michael's most personal songs, I mean, the fact that it's not written by him is, I think, something that people would not really equate, because he obviously wrote so many of his own hits that, you know, this song would be particularly interesting.
Yeah, I feel like this song got a whole new, life after he died, but it kind of did, and everyone suddenly just started focusing on the music, and it seemed like everyone really started appreciating this one all over again, and now a whole new generation has kind of grown up with this song.
And so many of the tribute articles or videos would always be like, Man in the Mirror, yeah. Michael Jackson, the Man in the Mirror, so yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you sort of alluded to this, Trevor, but the song does have kind of like a lightness to it, like that opening synth riff. It's very airy and like, I don't know if cheesy is the word for it, but it's certainly dated pretty quickly, I think, that specific riff and some of the other kind of like softer elements to the song. So like, I remember when I was growing up in the late 90s and into the new century, when like edginess was still more of an important thing, I think, in music criticism and kind of the general dialogue, like the song sounded very much of its time.
See, I disagree. I really do, because I base a lot of it on what still gets played on adult radio.
And but adult radio, there you go.
But I feel like if you hear Bad now, you hear some of those.
That's what I'm getting to is that after a certain point, when I think like that sort of 90s kind of edginess stopped being a priority, and certainly by the time of his death in 2009,
right? Okay,
it became less important, and it never was that important to begin with, really. But, you know, certainly if Michael was going for more of a hard edge sound on some of the Bad singles, this was not in line with that. But it's a great song, and it's an incredibly powerful song, and it's just a brilliantly structured song. And you know what the best part is, right?
We're talking about the key change.
We can talk about the key change. No, well, the chorus too, certainly. It's a great chorus. But the
key I said of course.
Oh, of course. Okay. Yeah. The key change, certainly, I would say top 10 all-time key change, probably. Did just a little pause before it and then just hitting you with that change.
It was kind of an 80s thing, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah.
I think an 80s production.
It sounds like to that point, it does sound like a lot of those like sort of charity songs. And I guess everyone kind of had one. I guess everyone kind of had one social song. It really reminds me a lot of Mariah Carey's There's Gotta Be a Way, that has that same sort. I mean, there's the same choir at the end. There's the same kind of like, just kind of like, general lightness, like kind of mentality about it.
The kind of production that like doesn't outlaw it from getting played on any radio station. That like it'll be there's no station that it'll be too hard for.
Right. I mean, it kind of hits that soft spot between AC pop. I mean, R&B can't avoid it.
Sure.
At the time, yeah.
But where I thought you were going to go with that was talking about Whitney's The Greatest Love of All. which I think most people would consider kind of the progenitor for Man in the Mirror. And I think they even talk about that in the Bad 25 documentary, is that he never had that song that clearly Whitney created a lane for.
Other than We Are the World.
Other than We Are the World. His name isn't on that song. Certainly he is a towering presence on it, but it's not his song. You can't put that song on a Michael Jackson album. But he had Man in the Mirror, and certainly that kind of form of a Michael Jackson ballad became something that he tried to go to over and over again afterwards, on Heal the World, or Will You Be There, or even You Are Not Alone. Right. Like that became kind of one of the standard Michael Jackson song forms. And then we get into a little murkier territory with the fifth single, this is Dirty Diana. It's the rock song on this one. It's even harder edge than Beat It, probably, but it also kind of follows the formula of getting whoever the hot rock guitarist was at that time, who in this case is Steve Stevens, who was Billy Idol's main guy, but I think he actually left like a month before the album came out. Probably hasn't endured, at least the Steve Stevens part of it, hasn't endured the same way as Beat It. It's not that sort of iconic rock meets R&B pop sort of thing. I still think it's a great song. What do you guys think of Dirty Diana?
I listened to it a couple times to try and gather my current thoughts on it. I mean, it's so hard not to compare it to Beat It, just given, who the artist is and, sure. and sort of what he was trying to do, perhaps, with it. I mean, it's not as good as Beat It. I'll give it that. It's okay. I mean, it feels a little forced. I mean, just because, I mean, again, and this is sort of that same thing with The Way You Make Me Feel. Like, Michael's okay, so Michael's bad, got these women problems, not in the same way as not in the same sort of clever way as a Billie Jean, which is based on a paternity lawsuit. Really,
I think you would say that even though this is more of a musically it's musically structured the same way as Beat It, the song that actually has the most in common with Thriller is probably Billie Jean, right? Like it's also like this kind of very dark and pulsing sexual melodrama, basically. Like it's got the same sort of scandalous recoiling feeling to it, where it's Michael Jackson kind of going like taking his hands away off, from the situation, right? Yeah. Like this isn't me, these girls are saying these things about me, but it's not me.
Yeah, musically I think it's more it's more like Beat It, just because
the Beat It was such an up-tempo song. It was such like an in-your-face kind of aggressive song,
but it's Michael going rock on sure. each album.
Yeah,
a lot of what Trevor said, I think it's again, maybe hasn't quite lasted the same way The Way You Make Me Feel or Man in the Mirror has. It's got a great hook. The chorus mm-hmm. is as catchy as anything you were going to hear at that point.
I mean, all it is Dirty Diana.
It's catchy, though.
But I guess if it look what you made me do is, that's six times selling, too.
And in those two words, he made like one of the song's biggest talking points, which is also kind of a proto-Taylor thing to do. It's like, who is the song about? Is it about Diana Ross? Right. Is it about Princess Diana? Turns out it's really not about anybody, or at least nobody named Diana, just some sort of anonymous kind of composite groupie. But it's certainly like I don't even know if Michael was doing that intentionally, but he was sort of ahead of his time in that way. But I'm going to make a statement about Dirty Diana that you guys may or may not agree with. I think like if you take pop music in 2017, this is the most influential of the five singles off Bad, because. And like you've even seen like artists cover it, like I think The Dream did a version of it. The Weeknd definitely did a version of it on his second mixtape. He just called it DD, but it's basically a straight version of the song. And The Weeknd especially, I think, like I don't think The Weeknd exists without this song. This the same sort of like lurking, kind of like sordid melodramas as like played almost as horror movies. Like this song is like very foreboding. It's very creepy. Like I don't think that you have a song like The Hills without Dirty Diana as precedent. I mean, does that make sense to you at all?
I like the Weeknd Michael Jackson comparison. Just if not mm-hmm. vocally, I think he's maybe as close as we're going to get to someone who sounds that way and brings back that type of vocal. Mm-hmm. I don't know. It's hard for me to look at Dirty Diana in the same on that same level that it's been as influential as something like Man in the Mirror.
Okay. Well, I don't know if you really. I mean, what would you say is like the closest version to a Man in the Mirror that you would hear in 2017? Like, what's an example of that song form kind of existing in the modern pop landscape?
Like a pop, just a pop ballad at this point.
Well, like a mega pop ballad with a social conscience and a real sort of sense of grandeur to it. It's pretty rare, I would think.
Yeah, I think we've seen this year that message songs in the last year or so maybe aren't exactly working. We've seen Katy Perry chant to the rhythm was probably fell mm-hmm. a bit short of expectations and for the political tie-ins there. I don't know. Hard to say specifically. I hear Man in the Mirror. I listen more for music than lyrics. So to me, it's just straight down the middle pop ballad that we still get nowadays, and those are always going to become hits.
So that's all five number ones, but it's not even really close to the end of the discussion on the album. I mean, the most amazing thing about Bad, I think, is that despite having five number one singles, I think some of the most famous songs on the album aren't even in that discussion. I mean, you got Smooth Criminal, which is probably, I don't know, certainly one of the two or three best remembered songs of this album. Leave Me Alone, which has, I think, my personal favorite music video off this album with him as kind of like the animated amusement park version of himself.
Did he win a Grammy for that music video too?
I think so. Yeah,
long form, perhaps.
Yeah, and it was a gigantic MTV hit. I think it was nominated for Video of the Year. Even Another Part of Me, I know some Michael Jackson fans think that that's one of the best songs on the album. I'm not personally one of them, but
I think it's good. I think it's got a good hook.
And it was also a top 20 hit. So what's your guys' favorite non number one single off this album? Or just not, doesn't have to be a single itself, but not one of those five songs. What's your favorite song on the album?
Yeah, I'd probably go with Smooth Criminal. Okay. I think. And we saw it remade by Alien Ant Farm, became a number one alternative hit in the 2000s. I just think it's a little weirder, a little experimental in some ways. So they put it out as the seventh single, and that it got to number seven shows that even if there's fatigue at that point, it still stood up as a top 10.
Yeah, and I think kind of reverse of what we were saying about I Just Can't Stop Loving You, if this had been the second single off the album, maybe it goes to number one.
Yeah,
I think
probably.
It certainly has a better chance.
Right, probably.
And what about you, Trevor?
I agree. I think Smooth Criminal is the best, I think. I mean, even though it kind of does borrow today, it sounds dated with that sort of industrial kind of garage production that probably Janet probably does better than anybody else. I also like the kind of difference in Michael's vocals on this song. I think it's the sort of short, choppy, breathy kind of vocals, I think, are something that we hadn't really heard too much of on a particular record, and so I like the way that he kind of changed that up. And obviously it's one of the songs that benefits from one of the iconic videos with the white suit and the lean and the way it's kind of sped up a little and maybe 1.25 times. And even the extended version is actually pretty cool. People haven't seen that. It's probably on YouTube. But for me, it's got to be that one.
All right. And just talking about the music video, like the really remarkable thing, one of the many really remarkable things off Bad is that I think all but like two tracks on it had music videos, which kind of shows just like what an important part of the culture MTV was back then. And this wasn't even like a Lemonade situation where they're all part of one like long continuous movie. But it's just nine. Though I think there was like a mini movie like Moonwalker that I think three or four of the videos were cut from. But aside from that, like it's an insane just commitment to the music visual format, and certainly MTV was perpetually hungry for Michael Jackson videos, so most if not all of them would get played. Quick shout out to Speed Demon, one of the few non singles, non videos, basically non.
You like that song?
I love that song. It's a batshit song.
Speed Demon.
It's got one of the most insane kind of like rhythmic logics to it of any Michael Jackson song, and there's parts to it that I forget are even part of the song. Listening to it this morning, there were whole different sections of it that I never remembered being part of it.
I think I don't like it because of the lack of cohesion, I think, between like all the parts of the song.
Well, but this is kind of the interesting thing about Bad, right? Like, I don't think anyone would say this is as cohesive an album as Thriller, and certainly not as Off the Wall, which is probably his like strongest front to back album in terms of just like this is like one sound and one kind of specific groove that I'm just going to master for 10 tracks. Bad is all over the place, even within the five singles. It's pretty off the wall, but there's a sort of fascinating quality to that. In that like it's this guy striving for perfection and coming up with something like extremely imperfect, but the results are still staggering. I mean, how do you guys rank this album compared to those last two albums?
Yeah, I don't think – I know that it's the one with the record. It kind of goes back to what we were saying. People might not expect this to be the one. I don't think it does stand up the same way as Off the Wall and Thriller. I think part of it is sort of an element of art or just human nature, not to have a pun. But when he's doing Off the Wall, when he's doing Thriller, he kind of didn't know how big he was going to become. And once you hit that point where you have that awareness – from that point, you're maybe trying to measure up to what you've done, and that kind of enters into the creative process a little bit and makes it a little less pure artistically in some ways. And you're thinking, is this as good as Thriller? Is this as good as Beat It? And you're kind of redoing certain songs. So I just feel like there's maybe in some way a little more authenticity to Off the Wall and Thriller than what you got on Bad. And same thing with Dangerous.
Yeah, well, I don't know about dangerous. Dangerous, actually, that's an entirely separate discussion. I feel almost bad getting into it now. We're already running so long here. But
you got the Charpie guys. We're going to go for an hour and a half once we have this song.
Dangerous, actually, I was listening to it this morning for the first time in a while. I was surprised by how cohesive it was. Like, because it was done, like, I guess, at the peak or maybe a little bit past the peak of New Jack Swing, and they had Teddy Riley, who was the New Jack Swing guy, kind of as the main producer behind the album. Like, the first six or seven songs of this, I was like, man, this is the best New Jack Swing album I've ever heard. Like, I couldn't believe how much it all felt like it was coming from the same place. And I guess as the album goes on, you get into, like, get into Black or White, you get into those big, like, Free Willy power ballads, and you get into a couple other sort of detours, it becomes less so. But I actually think that Dangerous is closer to Off the Wall in terms of the general consistency of the album than the two albums that were in between that. But generally, I do agree with you. It does feel like Bad was more of a self-conscious album. It was him trying to better himself, you know, trying to beat himself, as opposed to just trying to be the best version of himself. He was competing with himself in a much more explicit way.
But he's competing with, you know, the biggest pop star in the world. So for anyone else, an album like Bad would just be the biggest thing ever. He just happens to have these two other albums before it that you wind up comparing them to.
Only Went Diamond and had five Hot 100 number one singles. Right. It's certainly the most successful flop album in history, if you want to call it that. What about you, Trevor?
I don't know what I would put first or second, but I would probably put Bad third. Okay. I do agree with the same points. I mean, I think, and in hindsight, you know, I mean, Off the Wall came first, so it's sort of more the most influential, if you want to say, setting the ground for Thriller, kind of establishing that new lane of sound. Thriller, to me, is really not the most cohesive album, but, and I think there are reports out there that, you know, they really just set out to make the concept album for Thriller, the concept being they're all hits, which, you know, 7 out of 9.
Which I think makes it the most successful concept album in history. If that's what they were going for, you know, nail on the head on that
one. I mean, move over, Sgt. Pepper.
There you go.
But yeah, I think with Bad, I mean, really a lot of points that Gary said. I mean, there's an attempt to be bigger and better, I think, on all fronts than he did with Thriller. I mean, a lot of the songs have, whether it's repeating the same sort of genre or the same sort of message or melody or whatnot, it just feels like, you know, not bad, but you don't have to do that much bigger to be better.
Sure. All right. Well, as I said, we've gone way over here, so let's get down to the most important question of the day, which is 5 number ones off the same album. Will it happen again? And if so, who has the best chance of doing it?
I say no.
You say no, it won't happen again.
I do not think so, and I think you can come close, but I think the one problem that you're going to run into in this environment is streaming allows people to access all the songs so quickly that, you know, I mean, to have 5 top tens, perhaps, but I think, you know, I mean, because, you know, the biggest thing about a product to have 5 number ones is that it requires a year and a half of work, of strategy, of planning, of anticipation, and I think I just can't think of many albums that last a year and a half. I mean, Taylor's was obviously the last one. She had 5 top tens, 3 of those went to number one. But even she kind of benefited in a way by not having her things on Spotify, so people couldn't access them in the same way as easily as they wanted to. And, you know, maybe if they had been able to, it would not have happened. But I think just for that particular reason, the rush is so big, and I mean, to you know, sort of keep that anticipation up for a year and a half or so, I think is just too much.
Gary, what do you
Yeah, I'm not going to say it can't happen because
all records were meant to be broken.
I just think if Taylor could have 3 number ones plus there's no video for Style, right? Or it came out later though, right?
It came out the same day as Drake's If You're Reading This mixtape, so that kind of sucked the air out of that video, I guess.
Yeah.
But it was still – it was before it was done.
Okay. It was – but it was a little bit later in its – it didn't come right out off the bat.
I mean, it wasn't as well-timed to save blank space.
Right. So maybe if it had been – maybe if it had a bigger video around it, say that could have gone to number one. Wildest Dreams was still a really good song. It got to number 5. So it came close. And if something can get that close in the streaming era, I feel like the chance exists. Sure, it'll be absolutely difficult. It could be hurry. It could be, you know, who would have guessed that the weeks in the top 10 record, the Chainsmokers, would have so many weeks in the top 10. So maybe it's even by an act that we don't think of right now. Maybe someone will come along and there'll be that newness factor and people will just want the next song from them. So it could be a superstar or it could be something that's really out of left field. Who knows?
I think one thing that complicates that, though, is we see the question of the album being such a big, you know, I mean, if it is five songs from an album, I mean, in a way, you could argue that, you know, Bieber could have played that right if he'd had the right five songs on his album. But so many of them are standalones that, I mean, you know, as soon as you put out one standalone or something, that jeopardizes your chances.
You might see five number ones in a year before you see five number ones on the same album again.
I would agree with that.
Yeah, that's an interesting thought. And I think I agree very much with both you guys are saying. And I was thinking about it in terms of the Ed Sheeran album, which I think in another year might have had two or three number one hits by now. You know, not, which isn't to say that like he has necessarily the songs to do it with, but I think you saw with a number of things with the rollout of this album, they're very indicative of this era. You saw that he released the first two songs at the same time, which would never have happened in a bygone era. And Shape of You was the one that people latched onto, and it lasted forever. It lasted for 12 weeks at number one, and still in the top 10 now, which is pretty crazy. And the other songs, you know, most fans already know about them because the album's out there. You can listen to it as many times as you want. So there's not going to be that kind of new factor. Like, you know, when people heard The Way You Make Me Feel on the radio in 1988 and early 1987, a lot of people probably never heard that song before.
Right.
And a lot of people that would even be potential Michael Jackson fans had never heard that song before. They just never hadn't gotten around to buying the album yet. These days, if you care about Ed Sheeran, you've probably listened to Divide by now. And so that does make it very difficult to notch a third number one, a fourth number one, because the songs aren't new to anybody anymore. Radio doesn't have that same sort of introductory impact. But I would say that I also agree with your kind of never say never attitude, because we don't know what's going to change. You know, streaming is the dominant thing now, but we don't know what comes after streaming. And it could change the game completely again. I think this is sort of what we saw in the 23 years in between Bad and Teenage Dream. I'm sure after SoundScan came out, there were probably all sorts of people saying, never going to happen again. And SoundScan, I should probably say, is the technology that was introduced in the early 90s that kind of made Billboard sales reporting, you know, more distinctly accurate, right? Like, is that safe to say?
Sure.
And then after that happened, you started seeing number ones that would only have been two or three number ones before that are now 12, 14-week number ones. And, you know, the number of number ones per year dropped precipitously from like 26 a year to 12 or 13 a year. And now we're more in that 12 or 13 a year phase now. I'm not sure exactly how many we'll have this year. I think we had 11 last year, something like that. But the game will change again. And not to say that everything's necessarily cyclical, but everything is not locked in. Things that we take as givens now will not be a given 10 years from now. So that while I say that in the immediate future, it seems pretty unlikely this is going to happen again.
Right.
15 years from now, who knows?
And that's why it really was, it may be more unlikely for Katy Perry to tie this record in 2011. It was more of an outlier for its era than Bad was for its era.
That's so probably it stands true, even but it did, have the advantage of iTunes sales being a thing. It did have the advantage of these remix policies. That, you know, we're not super new to the time, but certainly didn't exist in the late 80s. Probably not until the 21st century, the idea of just kind of hopping on a remix and that being something to propel sales further. Happened a little bit in the 90s, but it certainly became more rote in the mid to late aughts, I would say. So, I mean, every one of these albums that comes close has its own advantages to its era. So, it's, you know, it seems like it'll never happen now, but who would have thought 5 years ago that the one-week sales record would be shattered the way it was, and right. So dramatically, too, right. by Adele's 25. So, yeah, I think you do have to never say never with this sort of thing.
We'll find out.
We'll find out in the next 10 years.
All right.
Can I give one last stat that I forgot to share about Michael Jackson? Michael Jackson, a pioneer on these charts. I didn't realize Off the Wall, first album by a solo artist to have four top 10 hits.
Really?
It was.
That is shocking.
Thriller, first album to have seven top 10 hits. Bad, five number ones.
Dangerous.
He got better and better.
Nice album.
Dangerous, a good record, yeah.
Good album.
But I mean, all those three iconic albums, all setting new records for him.
And I think wasn't he also the first artist to have a song debut at number one on the Hot 100?
He was.
Yeah.
Yeah. So even in the mid-90s, he was still setting new records, making new precedents, chasing that history.
The king.
If Trevor gives a stat, can I give a stat?
Sure, Gary. Let's hit us.
Right, give us a better stat.
I know. While Gary's coming up with this stat, you come up with another stat.
That's the problem.
We'll have a stat off.
I don't think it's better, but I think it's interesting that we were talking about another part of me before. It got to number 11 on the Hot 100, which is kind of weird after all these number ones, or maybe it made sense because the label kind of didn't care. They got the record at that point. But it did become the fifth number one from the album on the R&B Hip Hop Songs chart And that became the second album to do that. Janet's Control had done that. So both had the record.
So what was the other – what was the one number one single that didn't go to – that went number one pop and not number one R&B?
Dirty Diana got to number five.
Probably could have guessed that, I guess.
And then Smooth Criminal got to number two. So we almost got a sixth one.
Five number ones and a number two. That's pretty good.
Your stat may have been better, Trevor, but I want to be sure.
Okay. With Michael Jackson, certainly we could go back and forth all day. Plenty of stats to go around there. So thank you guys so much for coming on the podcast. This was a – this is one of the better crossover episodes, I would say. Not in that kind of Family Guy Simpsons realm, but I don't know, maybe Harlem Globetrotter Scooby Doo sort of thing. Like that's a quality crossover.
So we'll check the crossover charts. Get back to you on that.
And thank you guys so much for coming on.
Thank you, Andrew.
Thanks a lot, man.
If you're snacking on anything but tasty cake, you're making a huge Miss Cake. A fistful of chocolate-covered raisins? Miss Cake. A spoonful of peanut butter? Bigger Miss Cake. Or the worst Miss Cake of all, your kid's Halloween candy, and it's April. If it's not tasty cake, it's a Miss Cake, because nothing satisfies like a perfectly sweet butterscotch crimpet or rich and creamy chocolate peanut butter candy cake. Tasty cake. Accept no substitutes.
It's time for today's Lucky Land horoscope with Victoria Cash.
Life's gotten mundane, so shake up the daily routine and be adventurous with a trip to Lucky Land. You know what they say, your chance to win starts with a spin. So go to LuckyLandSlots.com to play over 100 social casino-style games for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Get lucky today at LuckyLandSlots.com.
Available to players in the U.S., excluding Washington and Michigan. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.